Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And welcome, Earth Explorers. All over planet Earth, we're coming to you live from southern Mississippi, about 90 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico. If you want to be part of tonight's program, and we encourage you to do so, our call-in line is 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet. If you're east of Earth, it is 530-413-4515. And if you are west of Earth, it is 530-413-4520. And if you're listening by cell phone, and we have a lot who do, you can do so at 712-432-0075. And then all you have to do is dial the access code 318-116-POUND. That way you can walk around with your Bluetooth in, with that distant look on your face as though you are privy to some information no one else has. The solar wind tonight, 434 kilometers per second. That's up a little bit. No worse for wear, all the solar flares that we've had, X-class and otherwise, in the last 4 days from our sun. And the proton count is way down to 0.2 per cubic meter. For the past week, all eyes have been on the Earth side of the sun, where sunspots 1158, which isn't just a single sunspot, it's a huge complex of sunspots, 100,000 miles long, some five times the size of Earth. And 1161 and 1162 have unleashed some of the strongest flares in years. Really not since 2004 have we seen flares of that power. It did cause problems with communications. Meanwhile, the far side of the sun has been busy too, and it won't be long before it's facing us. Regarding the Stereo B probe, it's been covering the first 20 hours of the 19th of yesterday. Yesterday was the 19th. A huge active region is transiting the far side, and it is crackling with flares. It will turn toward Earth in about a week. We'll keep you posted. By the way, we do encourage you to use the chat room at xsquaredradio.com. I will try to monitor it during the break to see what you're saying, but if I open the website and open the chat, you are entering things so fast. First of all, it's distracting to try to read it and talk at the same time. Second of all, it eats up the bandwidth of the hotel in which I am staying. I do not have a designated internet here. There are about 200 people using this same line. Well, I would say there are 200 people in a hotel. Not all of them are accessing the internet tonight. Some are just laying down watching TV. But that being said, if anyone gets on, it affects the quality of the sound going out. And rather than compromise that, go ahead and put your questions into the chat. And when we break at the top of the hour, I will access that and give that to you. If you want to access me through Skype, my Skype address is x2-radio, and you can send me texts, and I will read those questions as quickly as I can get to them. There are The remains of old sunspot complex 1147 Lynn 49 are around the other side of the sun now, and that may be what we're seeing crackling out there. Hard to say. Lots in the news. No time to cover it. We'll try to cover it at the top of the second hour. So hang in there, and we'll cover it. No worries about that. A lot going on in the political science region. As you know, Egypt is still not settled, and the call for change, the call for representation in the government, and don't listen to the news media that tries to tell you the nature of that representation, whether it's Islam or whether it's radical, anything compared to what was in there would be acceptable. Except that it probably will not be easy with which to negotiate for flyover rights and oil and other things like that. And so the news media are going to report it the way that they want to report it. They're going to slant it. And if you don't believe me, just watch the news, watch the screen, and listen to what is being said. That's what I did. And I can tell you right now, while the news anchor woman was reporting that the crowd was getting violent and angry and was ready to take the town apart brick by brick, behind her were hundreds of thousands of people in the square peacefully praying, going up and down with their hands in the air and then on their knees and then their foreheads against the streets, peacefully, quietly praying, listening to the prayer over the loudspeaker. Quite a bit different what I saw and what I heard, and I doubt very seriously I was the only one to catch it. But if you didn't catch it, you got it here because you're listening to X Squared Radio. There's a lot going on in the political science arena. States in the United States are becoming encouraged and are enacting sovereignty acts which will allow them as states to act as the United State of Tennessee and the United State of Texas and the United State of New Hampshire. Those citizens able to speak out to the federal government saying we are not being represented properly. I made some changes to the Kindle version of Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. I had a couple of you come back and say some of the images, some of the illustrations in the Kindle version of the book were not coming up. I went and reviewed it myself, and that was in fact the case. There are two reasons why images don't come up in Kindle. One is they're the wrong size. I didn't know this, but Kindle limits you to 450 pixels wide. Some of my pictures were larger than that, and so Kindle, rather than resizing them, just throws them out and gives you that annoying little box with the X in it. All of the images have been fixed, but in case you bought the Kindle version and you didn't get all the images, you're in luck. Because you can go to xsquaredradio.com and you can access the link or just go right to it, rememberingthefuturebook.com. And I have placed a page on there for all of the images. So if you did not see the images in the book, they're all on the website in color. So I would ask, please, that you don't right-click these images and paste them on your own stuff, not without asking me. So please have the courtesy of doing that. Some of the charts, some of the drawings in there are originals, and I would appreciate if you would ask my permission. No, I won't charge you. I just want to know where they're going. Other than that, if you see it somewhere else on someone's website, it isn't authorized by me. It will say authorized by me if it does. So I'm trying to accommodate all of those that have bought the Kindle, and there are a couple thousand that have bought the Kindles, and we appreciate it. Those of you that are interested in reading Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you can go to rememberingthefuturebook.com. The audio version is a free download when you buy the paper book, paperback, or you get the audio version for a mere $7.95, or you can go to Kindle or Nook, and you can download the book also for $7.95. A great savings. We are mindful of the economy and of people's pocketbooks, and we're also mindful that some of you out there may think that you're not the greatest reader, so don't worry about it. I read it for you. RememberingTheFutureBook.com. This week, I had the great privilege of being on the radio with my good friend Mel Fabregas on his radio program Veritas. So if you get the chance to listen to that interview or any of the interviews on Veritas, which is truth in Spanish, I would appreciate you visiting his website. He's a great guy. I know him well. He is also the new host of the Discovery Channel program Decoded, and we congratulate him on his success and appreciate him having me on his program. So please visit his website and patronize his great work. Those of you that have not got yourself prepared, I would like to say shame on you for not putting aside some pennies to do it. But I still encourage you to go to our good friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com. Paul Faust, former EMT, and his firefighter buddies after 9/11 saw a great need for people to have quick access to emergency preparedness goods, priced well, packaged well, free shipping. This is very high-quality stuff. Some of these food supplies will last for 25 years. So if you want to set it and forget it, emergency preparedness kit, a backpack, a book bag, a year's supply, 6 month supply, 72-hour kits, visit our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com. And while you're checking out, just put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, in the coupon code, and you'll get an extra 10% off. All right, we are ready to start. Tonight we are going to discuss what is going on with the Vostok Research Station. You've heard some bits and pieces. You've heard some rumors. You've heard some sensational stuff. Well, you're going to hear all the facts right here on X Squared Radio in 40 seconds. Don't go away. We'll be right back with X Squared Radio. The wind, the coldest place on the planet, Antarctica. Also, one of the best places to study the magnetosphere and the magnetic flux passing through the core of the Earth. It is also the site of the best observatory on Earth, second only, or only surpassing the observatory in Hawaii. And I've got to tell you that they've come up with a lot of new software that takes the twinkle out of the stars from the atmosphere. It corrects for that. So now Earth-based telescopes are able to gather as much light and correct for the atmosphere and bring you very, very high-quality information. Some have said that there is a planet, Planet X, Nibiru, traveling toward Earth. We have already covered the quantum possibilities of that being true or possible. The fact that it could be a free-floating planet for all intents and purposes in a very large elliptical orbit around two stars, our sun, and Sirius. I wonder what the planets around Sirius call our sun. Interesting. Well, anyway, the idea that it could be approaching from one of the poles and therefore not visible by telescopes or radar is possible, but not if it's coming to the South Pole, because you have an incredible observatory there. No such observatory in the north, though, in north countries of the United States and Canada, and also in Finland and Russia, yes, but not at the pole. No stable stations up there because the ice is just ice. There's no continent underneath it. The South, however, has been the site of great amounts of research. Vostok Research Station is located at 78 degrees 27 minutes 57 seconds south and 106 degrees 50 minutes 14 seconds east, which is a little hard to calculate because everywhere is north from there. It's about 1,300 kilometers from the geographic South Pole, so it's quite a ways from the geographic South Pole, at the center of the East Antarctic ice sheet and within the Australian Antarctic Territory. As a signatory to the Antarctic Treaty System, Australia does not exercise sovereignty over the territory. As such, many nations have contingencies at Vostok. That being said, the station is very small. It isn't the Hilton down there. This is a pretty small station with one drilling rig. And it's not a drilling rig like you think, an oil rig, you know, where you have a rotating bit that chews everything up into little chips and spits it out the top under high velocity air, or shoving mud down in the hole to push the cuttings to the surface. And then things are analyzed in little granules, like looking at a gravel parking lot coming up out of the ground or out of the ice. These are core drillers. So it is slow. It is painstaking. It is a little bit like taking a very long Bud Light can and drilling into the ice with it using a lubricant. And in this case, they like to use kerosene. And then capturing the bottom of that core and hauling it to the surface in segments, and then extruding it out of the can, out of the pipe, onto a rack where it can be stored at, in that area, is called ambient temperature, about minus 55 degrees C, which is plenty cold enough to keep it frozen. That being said, it's a tough environment in which to work. We have had people ask, why Vostok? Of all the space that's available on the Antarctic, why Vostok? Why did the station ever get constructed in the first place? Vostok is located very near the southern pole of inaccessibility and the south geomagnetic pole, making it one of the optimal places to observe changes in the Earth's magnetosphere. A great place of interest for universities and other such nonprofit organizations interested in such stuff. Other studies include actinometry, geophysics, medicine, and climatology, not the least of which is global warming. Now, you know, we have to wonder who pays for all of this. Well, largely governments do. They come up with grants, they give it to universities, universities propose papers, the papers are accepted, they're put on the military transports, usually a Hercules or a C-130, and they're transported down there with supplies, and they're allowed to stay during the Arctic summer, which is about as long as the summer in Detroit. Summer ends somewhere in the beginning of February, so by the time you get down there and get your supplies out and get acclimated. You know, you got to be acclimated. We'll discuss that here in a little bit. You're talking an area that has almost, well, zero relative humidity, of course. But the dew point is well below zero, minus 40, minus 50 degrees. We're talking extreme dehydration down there. Yes, you would turn into dehydrated fruit in no time at Vostok. So you have to drink a lot of water. You have to use a lot of precautions to keep yourself hydrated. And once you get acclimated, then and only then can you actually start to work. Now, once the station is fired back up again, people don't stay there year-round, okay? Once the station is fired back up again and the drill is thawed out and all the things that have broken during the wintertime or need to be lubricated and repaired and preventative maintenance done on is completed, you now have about 3 to 5 weeks of drill time. So you can see why their work is so slow and so painstaking and why it's taken so long. The station was built a long time ago. We'll discover that. The station is at 3,488 meters, which is about 11,444 feet above sea level. 11,000 feet above sea level. Those of you that have been to Lhasa in Tibet will realize that you leave Bangkok, Thailand, and you fly to Nepal. You stay in Kathmandu for one day, and then you change planes. And Kathmandu, of course, is very comfortable. It's kind of warm and humid even in April. You get on the plane in Nepal at Kathmandu, and you fly to Lhasa in Tibet. When you get off the plane in Lhasa, you're at 11,500 feet. Now, the plane is kept at about 6,000 feet while it's flying inside the can. When they open the door, you are instantly transported to 11,500 feet. You do not pick up anything. You do not go for a walk. You shuffle very carefully toward the hotel, and you go to bed. And it's nice to take Diamox, too. Diamox will help you assimilate oxygen. However, it makes carbonated drinks taste horrible. I thought they must make Coca-Cola so much different in Tibet because it tastes like Alka-Seltzer. Well, it wasn't the Coke. It was me. It was the Diamox that I was taking that helped me assimilate oxygen. In any case, in about a day or two, you can actually walk around without breathing your lungs out of your mouth, and then you're acclimated. That's in Tibet, where it's about 30 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, gets up to about 11 degrees C in Tibet in April. It doesn't get anywhere close to that in the Antarctic. So you are in for a grueling physical challenge, in addition to having to do whatever work it is for which you got the grant to go down there. The station is supplied from Miami Station on the Antarctic coast. The station typically contains only 25 scientists and engineers in the summer. In the winter, their number drops to 13. Oh, I was wrong. I was wrong. I misspoke. It is open year-round, but some of the diehards stay. There's only 13. Yeah, I know they have high-speed internet and everything, but not being able to go outside where it's 105 below zero might make it a little tough. You'd have to have very special clothing. Vostok Station was established on the 16th of December, 1957, during the International Geophysical Year by the Second Soviet Antarctic Expedition and was operated year-round for more than 37 years. The station was temporarily closed from February to November 1994. Now, somewhere in the middle, in 1974, British scientists in Antarctica performed airborne ice-penetrating radar survey, and they detected strange radar readings at the site, the presence of a liquid freshwater lake below the ice did not instantly spring to mind. In 1991, Jeff Ridley, a remote sensing specialist with the Mullard Space Science Laboratory, University College London, directed a European satellite called ERS-1 to turn its high-frequency array toward the center of the Antarctic ice cap. Now, when this was done, it confirmed the 1974 discovery that was done from aircraft. But it was not until 1993 that the discovery was published in the Journal of Glaciology. Yes, there's a Journal of Glaciology, and they have a trade show. And they have a magazine. Space-based radar revealed that the subglacial body of fresh water was one of the largest lakes in the world and one of some 140 subglacial lakes in Antarctica. Russian and British scientists delineated the lake in 1996 by integrating a variety of data, including airborne ice-penetrating radar imaging observations and space-borne radar altimetry. Now, just to give you an idea how that works, the radar is directional, and they set up very tight pattern antenna, and they broadcast the radar, pick up the bounce with these very tight array, usually square wave antennas, and they triangulate using the angle of the antenna times the tangent of the distance between the broadcast and that gives you the depth. And that's how it's done. Tangent of the angle times the distance apart gives you the distance down. Okay? Not the hypotenuse, but the height of the triangle. That's how it works. So they triangulate, and this is how they found the edges of the lake. Because this kind of radar can tell you where the edges are, but it can't really analyze very well what is in that body of water because it gets so distorted by going through ice. Now, if it was going through dirt or rock, we could tell very, very clearly what was in that based on the pattern. But ice is quite a different matter. It just doesn't go well through water. But you can tell the on and off point. You can tell the halo. You can tell the edge. And that's in the end, or out the lake. We'll hang in there. Very poor internet connection right at the moment. Hang on. We have to make sure the people that are listening to the program can actually hear what's on. Just give me a second. We're down to about... there we go. Now we're back. Okay, now... crap, we dropped the call. All right, well, hang on, people. I'm going to take a quick pause and we'll see if we can get to the other. Oh, we're still live. Okay, we still have smiles. No worries, we still sound great. I love my producer. He's so great. All right, let's continue. In the 1970s, the Soviet Union drilled a set of cores 500 to 952 meters deep. That's about half a mile. These have been used to study the oxygen isotope composition of the ice, which showed that ice of the last glacial period was present below about 400 meters depth. Then three more holes were drilled in 1984. Hole 3G reached a final depth of 2,202 meters. That's about a mile and a quarter. In 1990, hole 4G reached a final depth of 2,546 meters, almost 3 miles. And in 1993, hole 5G reached a depth of 2,755 meters. That's getting well below 3 miles. After a brief closure, drilling continued during the winter of 1995 because they really wanted to reach this destination. In 1996, it was stopped at a depth 3,623 meters by the request of the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research that expressed worries about possible contamination of Lake Vostok. And there were other worries as well. Because as I told you, they use kerosene as the lubricant for the drill. It's low enough viscosity, that is to say resistance to flow. And it does present a pretty good lubricant as it is an extremely light oil, but it is also a fatty acid, and it can support bacteria. It grows all kinds of wonderful things. they didn't want to break through this dome into the lake area and dump thousands of pounds of kerosene into that environment. And so this became a concern of the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. I quote, you know, they have classified Lake Vostok. They at first wanted to apply environmental reasons. This is why we don't want to break into this. The idea that it was very rich in oxygen was apparent because of the ice cores that they were hauling up out of the hole. Now, being a mere 130 meters from punching through the roof of this cavern, they had to drop back and punt. They had to come back and make a case. We can go into this, and we can keep from contaminating it, and we can investigate it. Now, the interesting thing was that recently, besides the lake, there was another anomaly that was discovered. They continually fly over it because they're getting better and better at ground probing radar or ice probing radar, higher frequencies, better antennas, slower aircraft, and they continually digitize the data so that they can get some topography more than 2 miles below the ice. And as they were passing over it, a very strange thing happened. A bigger anomaly came back than what they expected. Now, what I'm going to read you is controversial. I don't mean to propagate rumors, but I'm going to read to you what has been published, and then we're going to vet what has been published, and then we'll open the phone lines. The phone lines are open right now, but I know you're listening because you want to hear the facts, and I want to give them out. What we want to find out is what's really going on at Lake Vostok. We know since 1957 they've been drilling various cores, and it's been just highly interesting to all kinds of students, and they come back and further their careers at various universities because they've paid their dues in the frozen ice of Antarctica. And lo and behold, as they're working down there on various government grants, some of which come from JPL, Jet Propulsion Labs, some of which come from various universities and benefactors and people that just want to have access to the data, something strange happened. This is the controversy. Quote, you know, they have classified Lake Vostok. I don't know who they is, but hang on. They took it away from JPL, who were monitoring it. You are familiar with Lake Vostok in Antarctica? Under the ice in Antarctica, there's a freshwater lake deep, deep down under the ice. That's 100 miles long and 50 miles wide, freshwater. The temperature in the lake is about 65 degrees. I assume that's 65 degrees F, which is pleasant swimming, you might say. But at the end of Lake Vostok is what's known as a gigantic mass con, a mass concentration of metal. Very similar to the mass cons they discovered on the moon. A gigantic, circular-shaped, metallic object deep under the ice at the end of Lake Vostok. The National Security Agency took it away from JPL. It's one of the most sensitive things in the world now, the anomaly at the end of the lake. It's now classified top secret. Well, there are a number of discrepancies here, which we're going to discuss. We have aspects and angles of it from different reporters and even the people that actually issued the original report. Whether it's the National Security Agency or the National Science Foundation remains to be seen. Whether JPL even had jurisdiction over it in the first place, and thus whether they could even lose it, is also part of the controversy. And the other idea that it's now classified top secret, we just don't know. But truth can be stranger than fiction. geothermal activity and the 3 kilometers of insulating ice at the pole can trap heat and melt sections of the ice sheet's base. If some of that water begins to collect in basins, it can form a lake, as it would anywhere else on Earth. Subglacial lakes are potentially very valuable treasure troves for interesting biota and paleoclimate information. This is according to the scientist Anand Dakrishnan. He added that sediments left in the lakes may give clues as to the history of the ice sheet itself. All of this is very fascinating because it can tell us about what the atmosphere was like on Earth some 14 million years ago. That could be very, very important to know. We don't want to repeat history here. We do have a very clear frozen picture of what the atmosphere was like on Earth from the surface all the way down to the bottom some 14 million years old. And it tells a rather big story, which we will get into in the next hour. Aerial radar surveys have flagged hundreds of these lakes with large surface areas dwelling under the ice. The subglacial lake at the South Pole was the first identified using this method in the late 1970s. The largest is, of course, Lake Vostok, which we're discussing tonight, which sits 4 kilometers beneath Russia's Vostok Station. At 10,000 square kilometers, it's a little bigger than Lake Ontario. Lake Vostok is the sort of crown jewel of subglacial lakes, so we have to be very careful before we try to sample there, Anand Dakrishnan said, as of the lake that reaches more than 500 meters deep. So the lake water is 500 meters deep. Now, it's under a lot of pressure. It has not been exposed to light, or so we think. And they have the idea that maybe they can poke a camera through there. What in the world they see, I have no idea. In the darkness of that cavern above the lake, maybe they have a wide-angle lens with its own light. Maybe they have infrared and a source for infrared radiation that they can put down there, that maybe they can get some picture of what's down there. But the idea is that some radiation is coming through to the surface from this metallic mass that's down there. It wasn't there, and now it is there, which leads us to think that maybe there's some kind of power supply down there that has sprung a leak. A power supply in a metal mass some 45 miles wide, 65 miles long, sitting at the end of a 100-mile-long lake underneath the ice at Antarctica. Very interesting indeed. There have been ideas as to how this metal could accumulate in this area. Some have said, well, it could have accumulated naturally. You know, it could be just a big pile of gold. It could be a big pile of uranium. Well, if that's the case, it is a pile of uranium. It would have been giving off radiation as far back as the first probes or first scans over that ice. It also would have been the subject of a much larger contingent. You know, we're only talking 25 people. If you've ever looked at an aerial shot of the Vostok station, it kind of looks like about 3 or 4 mobile homes, you know, like houses stuck out on the ice with a little bitty core machine sitting out on the ice. Now, you can see it from space with high resolution. I have in my possession a copy of the high resolution image from space of Vostok Station and the other underground lake. You can see the lake. You can see the location of the station. You can see the road that leads from the station, the airstrip, so it's properly oriented. And there's just interesting stuff there because there's some controversy, and it's flying around all over various websites. and has been the subject of very recent, like 2 weeks ago, news articles about this. And we want to try and clear it up tonight if we can. So if you want to be part of that, and we encourage you to do that, it's very strong. 413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Or if you're listening at 712-432-0075 with the access code 318116#, you can't do anything about it because you can't communicate with us, but you can listen. And it is highly fascinating that we have thought that there's this giant station down there at Vostok, and there just isn't. It's just a collection of a few mobile homes, well insulated, of course. And what they did to try to discover what is down there, and they've had all kinds of ideas. I mean, it's not like you have anything else to do when you're down there. You're at 11,400 feet above sea level, so there's not much air to breathe. Those of you that have slept at night in very dry climates will realize right away you have all kinds of physiological problems. The Sandman literally pours sand in your eyes in the morning. You have a tendency to exhale about 6 pounds of water a day, so you have to replace it. You've got to pour water back into your body, or you're going to dehydrate like an apricot down there in the Arctic weather. Now, radar was used to scout out the 15 by 15 kilometer site near the South Pole, as well as the other lakes that spread out across the continent, but they're not drilling all of them. Vostok is the main one. And it can only provide a two-dimensional picture because the water reflects radar signals, frozen water, ice. The radar can't penetrate down through there. Now, it does, but it reflects off of it, and it distorts. And you can sort of get a background distortion for ice and a background distortion for water, and you can compare the two, and so you can tell where there's liquid water and where it's solid. And therefore, radar can provide information on a lake's area, but it can't penetrate the surface to explore what lies beneath. So they had to use seismic reflection. The principle behind seismic reflection profiling is much more straightforward than its name suggests. Make a sound at the surface and listen for the echo. Now, in the oil business, this is traditionally done with dynamite. You have a crew that goes out and lays the geophones out on the ground. You cover them, or sometimes they have a nice insulated soundproof box that goes over each one, but you lay out your array on the ground. It's quite expensive, by the way, about $20,000 a day to set this up. And then you strategically place your charge, which is usually done by digging a pit into the ground, putting the explosives into it, or drilling a hole into the ground, putting the explosives into it, covering it with sandbags, and then setting off the charge. Now, when the charge goes off, it obviously thumps the ground pretty good. Not much of an explosion above ground, but it does go down into the ground, and it bounces off solid things and bounces around inside of hollow things, and so you get a sort of a jaggedy edge picture of what it looks like underground. What's in it? Nobody knows. You cannot tell by seismology, but you can find the voids. And in Dakarshinen and his team needed an extremely loud sound to make it down several kilometers through the ice, not rock, to the lake, and then echo back to the surface again. And so they turned to, looks like pentaerythritol tetranite, which is PETN. It's one of the strongest known high explosives. It is the active ingredient in plastique, okay, PET. These red crystals, which you can make yourself with a few household chemicals, not very stably, of course. You smack it with a hammer and it's going to blow up. but you can mix it with plasticizer and you can get explosions somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,500 meters a second, which is far more powerful than dynamite. The team made its 5-centimeter-wide holes, 18 to 30 meters into the ice. 5 centimeters is about, 10 inches or so. About 2.5 inches. A centimeter is just a skunch over a half an inch. So somewhere around 2.5 inches, and then 18 to 30 meters into the ice, somewhere around 100 feet into the ice with a hot water drill that spits out 93 degrees Celsius water, which is pretty close to steam, and lowered an explosive into each one. Now, when the sounds hit the lake's surface, part of the signals were reflected, but part of them were continued to the bottom of the lake, where they would then bounce back and gave scientists an idea of what the bottom of the lake looked like. The reflected signals were recorded on the surface of the ice by 150 geophones, as I said, which operate much like microphones but record vibrations in the ice instead of in the air. And then those are sort of scratched out or recorded digitally, and then you get this picture of what it looks like down there. It doesn't give you any idea what the content might be. No chemical content at all. Absolute wild guess as to what the airspace above that lake is. They will not know unless they take a headspace analysis. Now, these lakes could be formed from subcrustal volcanic activity, and if that's the case, there could be methane, there could be sulfur, all kinds of things in that atmosphere. There are speculation that it is hyper-oxygenated, which would make it very, very good for growing microbes, which, as we know, can grow quite well as long as you have temperature and oxygen. And some of them don't even need oxygen. They're anaerobic, which means they don't need air at all. So if there's a void there, I can promise you there is life there. Now, the idea that crosses people's minds, and it does mine too, is what if we're not talking about, you know, snowfall upon snowfall upon snowfall upon snowfall, making a glacier, and the glacier getting older, millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, it gets thicker and thicker, it grows and grows, just as we see it growing, and then some geothermal activity underneath melts out a cavern. Obviously, ice takes up more space than water, and so you end up with airspace above a lake. That makes perfect sense. But what about the question that perhaps on the continent below the ice was once a civilization, was once life of some kind, prehistoric life, obviously, paleontology of the most ancient, and it is somehow captured in that ice, frozen in time, protected from the elements. Now, this is why the drilling was done where it was done. The subsequent years' drilling was slow and tedious and was designed not to actually reach the lake with all haste, but to capture cores from the ice, a record of the Earth going back, well, they've gone back 420,000 years, they estimate, and they can go back to 14 million years if they get all the way down. Now, the Antarctic Treaty Secretariat stopped the drilling in 1998 from continuing in order to come up with a way to preserve the lake from contamination. The drilling hole is filled with kerosene, by the way, to prevent freezing of the bit in the hole. That would be a disaster if you actually got your bit frozen in the hole. And there's quite a bit of kerosene in that hole, so they don't want to dump it into the lake. That would be a toxic spill in a pristine environment. Now, the team has satisfied the Antarctic Treaty Secretariat, which safeguards the continent's environment, that it has come up with a technique to sample the lake without contaminating it. Valerie Lukentold, New Scientist, once the lake is reached, the water pressure will push the working body and the drilling fluid upwards in the borehole and then freeze again. the next season, the team will bore into that frozen water to recover a sample whose contents can then be analyzed. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Except there's one problem. Once they drill into the ceiling of this cavern, they have some meters to go, maybe quite a bit, before they actually get to the water. So if they drill into the airspace is going to escape up the hole, but not the water. Unless they're able to put the drill pipe all the way into the water and seal the hole around the drill pipe. If they can do that, then the pressure of the water beneath might be enough to push it up some 2.5 miles to the surface. Now, I don't need to tell you that 2.5 miles of headspace with water is going to be quite heavy. It may not make it to the surface. It may only make it part of the way up. But the airspace would easily make it all the way up. If it was high enough pressure, it would blow the much lighter kerosene right out of the hole. Now, kerosene is about 25% less dense than water. So it may blow the kerosene right out of the hole, in which case they would have a geyser on their hands of gas coming out from underneath the Antarctic cap. And that would be not good. We wouldn't have to worry about contaminating that pristine space. We would have to worry about bacteria and possibly viruses that have not had an open breeding ground above ground for millions of years, and most likely for which we human beings and other animals, bacteria and such, fish, have no immunity. So that would not be a good situation at all. And I'm sure that has come up in the meetings as well, because we just brought it up here. And, of course, we're not nearly as smart as the people that work at Lake Vostok, I am sure. Duncan Gear wired this story into the UK. And this is where things get a little heated. This story is the thing that started it all. And the fire has been lit, and the grass is burning right up to the foothills of the Pentagon. We don't really know what's going on. We don't know who's in charge. We don't know who's going to say no or yes. One thing's for sure, a lot of money is interested in this project right now. Duncan Gear wired the story into the UK, wherein he noted that Lake Vostok, which has been sealed off from the world for 14 million years, is about to be penetrated by a Russian drill bit. The drill bit currently sits less than 328 feet above the lake. Once it reaches 65 to 98 feet, the mechanical drill bit will be replaced with a thermal lance that's equipped with a camera. Time is short, however. It's possible the drillers won't be able to reach the water before the end of the current Arctic summer, and they'll need to wait another year before the process can continue. You don't want to penetrate into this when it's 100 below zero outside. There's not much you can do about it. You can sit down there and watch TV and read instruments and very carefully walk from building to building as the wind gets up to 80 and 90 miles an hour and the solar radiation. As the sun disappears for more than 5 minutes and the entire place is plunged in mist, goes almost nothing. You have no heat, no light whatsoever. It is dark. You get up, you go to the dark, you walk in the dark. It's completely dark. Nothing but stars, which makes a great place for an observatory. Now, this is where the story gets interesting, and I really want to delve into it, and I want to do justice to it, so we're gonna begin in the next hour. I want you to encourage you to call in. I want encourage you to pay close attention, because this story doesn't get covered from all angles, from a lot of places. We're going to here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. If you're a first-time listener to X Squared Radio, this is called the X Squared Radio program. Instead of the show, is because it is not a show. We do scientific talk radio here. We talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And the reason the name of the radio program is after a mathematical function, x squared, y equals x squared, is because the results are always positive here. Even though we talk about controversial subjects, we always try to let the guests, if we have guests from around the world talking on various subjects, we let them tell their story. We don't attack them. We don't question their veracity or their credentials. That's not our purpose here. That's your job. When the story is told, when all the facts are laid out, you make the decision whether the story holds water or not, whether the evidence fits the case, whether the theory is sound, and not me. And so the program is named after a mathematical function, because the only number that you could put into the function x squared, where you could come up with a negative number, is the imaginary number, this is I, the square root of negative 1. If you take the square of the square root of negative 1, you'll get a negative number. And that's why I am not the subject of the radio program. The information is, maybe my ability to bring you that information, to analyze it, to perhaps delve into claims that are made by guests on this program, that perhaps, but it doesn't center around that. So that's why X Squared Radio is what it is. It is the cream of scientific. It is the number one paranormal internet talk radio program on the internet. And we've been around since 2005. Over 1,000 hours of archives on the BBS radio network. We're proud members of it. Been here for quite a few years, and we're one of the few three-hour talk radio programs. And we've been on Sunday nights for years, and we're glad you're here with us. We will take a short break, let you grab something to munch on. Let me pour something liquid down my throat so I can talk for another hour, and we'll listen to Nick. Thank you. If you'd like to be part of X Squared Radio tonight, you can call us in live between 5 and 8 o'clock Pacific Time each Sunday evening at 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. And if you'd like to be part of the program without participating, but just walking around listening, you can do so by calling in on your cell phone at 712-432-0075 and using the access code 318-116. Lots of things happening in the world today, especially in the world of political science, and we have covered that from time to time in this program for the mystery of it. Not so much to participate in the political process, but to ignite or perhaps awaken inside of you the idea that you are a member of a society of earthlings, regardless of what your national heritage is, regardless of what your earthly genetics might be. You most likely are an eternal being having a mortal experience. And that sometimes we get caught up in the material world, so to speak. We get more worried about how many toys we have in our garage. We punctuate our lives with paychecks or family vacations or major purchases instead of managing it by moments. And what we have seen is a phenomenon over the last 50 years in the world. The separation of continents, the separation of nationalities, even inside the melting pot called America, even inside the melting pot of London in England, which is unbelievably metropolitan in its social makeup, we still see this segregation. We still see this separation. And this should not be. However, what we are also seeing is not a resurgence, but an awakening of the idea that the governed is a little tired of being ruled, and they want to be governed. They want to be represented. Even in this country, in the United States of America, we have, it seems, arrived at a point where we are ruled by our federal government, instead of governed by our federal government. And evidently, the governors and legislatures of states agree with that assessment. And one by one, they are passing their sovereignty acts. And in other words, they are declaring that all that comes out of Washington is not immediately blessed and must be ratified inside the state before it becomes functional. And sooner or later, the states are going to question whether they should be sending all of that revenue, which has been confiscated from its citizens, to a government who is just paying it out to other countries. And we may yet see that awakening. Maybe not like Egypt, maybe not like Bahrain or Palestine, but we will nevertheless, one by one, a dozen or two dozen or three dozen, it only takes 37 states to actually make something happen. We'll move away from a country ruled by bureaucracies and back to one governed by the representatives of the republic. And we're seeing that happen because it's a politically scientific analysis. that we are observing and about which we report from time to time. As we see these scientific discoveries come to fruition, and whether they're molecular, biological, or whether they're cosmological, or whether they're psychological, and we've had several great psychologists on this program talk about this phenomenon, there seems to be a social awakening as this science gets out there. There seems to be a metamorphosis that's occurring because of this neural network we call the Internet. We call the World Wide Web. By the way, the very word web was used anciently to predict what would occur in these days, in these times. Connecting, interlacing people together, connecting their minds across time and across distances through history and even into the future, and allowing one people, no matter what continent they're on, no matter what age they are, to speak together and to thus corroborate with their idea and with their emotions and with their passions and with their dreams. And these are the kinds of things that change worlds. As we evolve past what all accounts said was the greatest invention of all time, which was the Gutenberg press, the idea that books did not have to be scribed one from another at the whim of whoever was paying the scribe or the scribe himself, certain errors, omissions could be made. Not so with the printing press. One copy is just like the 30,000th copy is just like the 30 millionth copy. And the proliferation of ideas in print changed the world, began a renaissance, which we've taken reprieve from a few times since that time. But in 1996, the web became a reality. This neural network at high speed began to lace itself through our society and in other societies. And here we are 15 years later, and we have transformed the world. We are now doing commerce at lightning speed all over the planet. Self-publishers are publishing. Scientists are publishing their papers, not in the mainstream magazines, no longer for peer review, no longer that long tread from the back row to the front row to be accepted by your peers. It instantly goes out. And that knowledge is available to bright people all around the planet. And those bright people are using the very leading edge information. And they're creating new companies. And they're creating new theories. And they're making new breakthroughs. And that is changing the planet. And what we once thought was true, what we once thought was solid, what we once thought was reliable, has now become fable as we move dimensionally past all of that and we metamorph, we change, we evolve as a people. And that is happening right before your ears tonight. You are part of it. You are becoming empowered. And when you're empowered, you can then make informed decisions on what it is you believe, what it is you think. And if you think, you will act. And if you act, you will change. And if you change, then your community will change. Your community changes, then your state changes. And if your state changes, sooner or later, a critical mass will be reached and a nation will change. So let's see what we can do about this empowerment. 40 seconds. We'll break back into Lake Vostok, and we'll discover where this controversy is taking us. Oh, my goodness. And then we'll let you be part of the program. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Radio is about to launch. Thank you.
Frozen ice of Antarctica lies Lake Vostok. Set up in 1957, drilled around and toward for more than 50 years. We're now getting close. We're now within a football field's distance, and if they're drilling the way we think they're drilling, we're now within 100 feet of piercing into what was once a pristine environment 14 million years old, and we get to see what our past was like. As we take a headspace analysis of a lake trapped more than 2 miles beneath the ice. Now, this is where the story gets interesting. Supposedly, the NSA has seized upon the nature of the magnetic anomaly and has taken over the project from the JPL and from the Arctic team. Apparently, the site has been sealed off to the media and other scientists due to the environmental concerns, the fact that the NSA has assured jurisdiction over an environmentally hazardous site is raising eyebrows about what may be happening there. Now, the controversy is far and wide. First of all, is it the NSA or is it the National Science Foundation? The second is, did JPL have any jurisdiction over this whatsoever, or was this entirely the Australian environmental team that was running this? The other is, to say that it's sealed off from media might be a stretch, because there are only 25 beds in the place, okay? And I don't know many reporters that are willing to take a three-month extended report in an area that is so environmentally hostile, in which you could actually die. Altitude sickness is a common ailment. I know this because we took an 11-person team to Tibet, and we tried to make our way to base camp, 23,500 feet. We made it to about 14,000 feet, and four of our team could not go any further. They had to take another route. And because four of our team could not go any further, the rest of us were not allowed to. So we went to 18,500 feet, the overland way by road, while the others took the lowland way in a four-wheel drive, and we met up in Nepal. That being said, it was a tough journey. You know, 14 days on the Tibetan plateau above 12,000 feet, you'll find out what you're made of. But here's the controversy from a NATO official, quote, you know, they have classified Lake Vostok. They took it away from JPL, who were monitoring it. Are you familiar with Lake Vostok in Antarctica? Under the ice in Antarctica, there is a freshwater lake deep, deep down under the ice that's 100 miles long and 50 miles wide, freshwater. The temperature in the lake is around 65 degrees. I assume that's Fahrenheit, which is pleasant swimming, you might say. But at the end of Lake Vostok is what's known as a gigantic mass con, a mass concentration of metal, very similar to the mass cons they discovered on the moon, a giant circular-shaped metallic object deep under the ice at the end of Lake Vostok. The National Security Agency took it away from JPL. It's one of the most sensitive things in the world now, the anomaly at the end of the lake. It's now classified top secret. Is it? Now, supposedly, that NATO official has responded to the claims. And this is his response. And I'll tell you what his name is. We always try to reveal our sources. Nothing is classified here on X Squared Radio. You will never hear, and I will never allow a guest to not reveal evidence on this program on the grounds that it's classified. If they got it, it's either not classified or it won't be by the time we're done with the program. Here we go. This is his words. I have received several emails from irate Antarctic personnel and others upset at my article concerning Lake Vostok and, quote, NSA override cover-up, close quote, as shown on the website. Not my website, but the website that claimed that this occurred. I'm not going to name the website. Basically, you seem to think I verified and am the source of the anonymous NSA override cover-up story that started this entire discussion, which I was not. I will continue to quote this individual, this source, and then I will give you his name, so hang in there. Whilst reviewing the recent post on the website that started this whole thing, it has become obvious that the ex-Nexus, ex-Scientific American, ex-Anonymous, believed to be an NSA JPL insider, NSA override cover-up storyline, as reproduced there, does give the impression that I have written it and verified it. I am sure that this is purely an editing error, obviously giving him the benefit of the doubt, whilst attempting to cull the various dispatches forwarded to you by me a few months ago. In fact, and this is in capital letters, I did not write it, nor have I verified its veracity. And in later emails on the subject matter over the last few months, I have raised several red flag outpoints concerning different aspects of this allegedly true NSA override cover-up anonymous story. In short, I am reasonably certain that 90% of the original anonymous story is a concocted piece of expletive that was fostered upon Nexus Magazine via Scientific American Magazine from persons unknown for reasons unknown. He goes on. Some basic aspects of the original anonymous story are factual. Now get this. For example, hold on a second. I hit the wrong mouse button. I want to expand this cell here because I've got some of it cut off on the bottom. There we go. Here we go. Some basic aspects of the original anonymous story are factual, for example, regarding the Lake Vostok magnetic anomaly and potential environmental dangers of drilling there. So the magnetic anomaly is real. What I have done is to append to my advisory emails to you and others on this anonymous storyline my own views on geological aspects and info from my discussions on matters geological with Professor Thomas Gold, which he was keen to see go public, as regards to the Lake Vostok magnetic anomaly and the possible truth of the environmental gas emission dangers reported in this anonymous story. Regards, Harry Mason. All right, Harry Mason is the individual that wrote this, and he's not hiding about it. Now, the report that the NSA took over the project is not verified, but the observation that there is a magnetic anomaly exists is true. Aha. So Professor Delaurier's paper discussed the existence of a structure so vast that it defied imagination. A quasi-cylindrical loaf of an object measuring 65 miles long by 65 miles thick at a staggering depth of 80 miles. The huge structure had been detected by seismic equipment located at ALERT, one of the U.S.-Canadian distant early warning stations in the Arctic wilderness. This is the one that's in the North Pole, obviously. Studies show that the object which straddled the Earth's mantle and crust was the source of some sort of disturbance, similar to the situation encountered at Lake Vostok 30-odd years later, affecting the magnetic field at ALERT facility and inducing a strong flow of electricity. What has now come out is that there are two of these, one in the north and one at the south, at the edge of the lake at Vostok. Other sources have not provided much additional information regarding the mysterious Antarctic lake, and the controversy rages on across the internet, while hundreds of different opinions clash over the nature of the goings-on at this remote location. Obviously, its remoteness is part of its mystique. Official sources have not provided any help on this. Harry Mason deals with interpreting aeromagnetic imagery daily in his mineral exploration work. The huge size and intensity of the above-mentioned magnetic anomaly strongly suggests very large ultra-basic complex is present below this section of Lake Vostok in the continental crustal rock surface, for example, at the old land surface pre-ice level. Now, this is important because the pre-ice level means before the first snowfalls occurred that created the Antarctic cap, which would mean it wasn't so cold. And that's what we're going to get into in this hour. This would fit with the apparently tensional pull-apart rifted tectonic style of the lake geo-environment and would probably represent a major mantle-derived plume of ultra-basic intrusives along the line of Professor Carey's expanding Earth theory. This fits the stretched crust model noted by Studinger, which we quoted above. Now, I'm going to throw in here the idea of what expanding Earth theory is. And you know, some of the geologists out there call this the tensional pull apart. Obviously a translation from another language, because that's not the way English or American would say it. And as such, it would also fit Professor Gold's hypothesis that there is a substantial, possibly world climate dangerous amount, if released, volume of methane gas as hydrate as the expected temperatures, plus oil and other exotic gases, helium, xenon, etc., components of the hot water lake source of the mantle core along the upwelling structural plumbing. So they're trying to tell us that if this hole is punched and this Vostok complex is allowed to explode, more or less like poking a hole into a balloon, it geysers up out of that hole. I doubt this little 25-man station with its little 6,000-pound rig is going to be able to stop that thing from geysering and melting, blazing a hole through that ice, and literally flashing everything that is liquid down there to gas and out that hole. They're just not going to be able to stop it. I think it's incredibly irresponsible to not have enough equipment down there to stop that thing from geysering if it decides to let go. I have been there. I've been in the oil fields. I know what it's like to drill into something that's unexpected. We did not expect it. It will lift the rig right off the ground. I have personally crawled under a steel trailer to avoid getting hit by steel that's being spit out of a hole because it was drilled into high-pressure gas. It comes out of there like a giant string of Tinker Toy sticks, and you dive out of the way while the steel crashes around you. It's no fun, and it takes you by surprise. I can tell you that these people might be skilled at drilling ice cores, but they have no idea what it's like when a 2,000 PSI well lets go. You're not going to stop it. When it comes out of that hole, it sounds like a jet going off, and nothing is going to valve it off unless you've got casing in that hole, you've got blow-off preventers in that hole, This is something that's well understood in the oil and gas industry, and that's not what they're set up to do. If you don't believe me, I will post the picture at the website. This is a space image of the Vostok complex. Believe me, it's a handful of mobile homes and a little tiny 3-ton oil rig, or not oil rig, but a core drilling rig. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's like being out in your backyard punching fence post holes. That's what they're attempting to break into this ice with. They're irresponsible for bursting into an environment which is capped by 2 miles of ice and letting it into our atmosphere. But that's only part of the controversy. The rest of it is this metal complex that they say that is at the edge of this lake. Now, is it an accumulation of a bunch of iron and nickel or titanium and aluminum or gold and magnesium rock that happens to be exposed at this edge of this lake? Or is it something that was on the ground and was snowed on and eventually shifted to the South Pole and is trapped under the ice? And is there more trapped under the ice? This is what's interesting. Is there a power supply in this that's giving off this radiation that's allowing this to melt away and create this liquid water down there? And that's why what's sitting on the edge of this is now exposed. The controversy is not put to rest, I must say. In 2001, a brief announcement, NASA and the JPL terminated all further study of Lake Vostok in South Antarctica in an apparent slip of confidentiality. Spokeswoman Deborah Shingteller alluded to national security issues, allowing the NSA to assume full control of what had been an international effort to explore a huge under-ice lake near the Russian Vostok Research Station. I will read that again. In an apparent slip of confidentiality, spokeswoman Deborah Shingteller alluded to, quote, national security issues, allowing the NSA to assume full control. Ms. Shingteller was immediately led away from the podium, and an aide responded to the many further questions with the same answer. The project has been halted due to environmental issues. I'm sorry, we're not going to answer that question today. The project has been halted due to environmental issues. No, Ms. Shingteller was not corrected. It's not national security issues. It is environmental issues. No, we're not going to take that question. No, I'm sorry. The NSA, that was a misnomer. She meant NASA. Well, yes, that would be NASA. Why didn't she say NASA? I don't know. It was a slip of the tongue. Okay, the project has been halted due to environmental issues, and that no further releases were pending. The large crowd of press corps were left clamoring as the officials left the stage. Ms. Shingteller has not responded to repeated attempts at contact, and is now serving in Minot, North Dakota. I'm kidding about the last part. The above is a report from an official JPR, a JPL press release representative who attended the announcement. He was there, and he heard her say it, and the questions were flying, as I just said they might have done. Wait a minute, Ms. Shingteller. Did you say NSA? You meant the National Security Agency? This is a national security issue? How in the world, Ms. Shingteller, could 5 little mobile homes stuck out on the ice for more than 50 years, drilling 30, 40 meters at a time, cataloging ice, be a national security issue? What are you talking about? I'm sorry, Ms. Shingteller has been led off the stage and an aide has taken her place. She didn't mean it. That's not what she meant to say. It's a translation problem.
Sure it is. Sure it is. All right, you got any ideas on that? 530-413-4511. National security issues? 530-413-4515. What is hidden beneath the ice at Vostok that would present a national security issue? Why would you stop drilling into something that's nothing more than headspace of a geothermal lake? You wouldn't. A team of scientists from Columbia University, working under the auspices of the NSF, National Science Foundation, early in 2001 began a series of unprecedented low-altitude aerial surveys over Lake Vostok. I say unprecedented because they had not been done ever before. 1957, they started doing what we would consider ground-probing radar. It's kind of low-tech to be done back then. But in 2001, I was doing it in 1987, but on dry land. Yes, I did try it over snow-covered land in the overthrust area of Wyoming. It didn't work. We couldn't see 20 feet below the frozen tundra there. For some reason, ice blocks the signal or scatters it so badly that we don't get any strength back on that signal. So it's difficult to do. It can be done, but it takes more time. You have to do triangulation. You have to compare your readings. It's difficult to do. You have to be very skilled with it, and I doubt very seriously before 2001 there was anyone in the world as skilled as my team was. Early in 2001, however, they began a series of unprecedented low-altitude aerial surveys over Lake Vostok. And I got to tell you, when you're flying at 140 miles an hour or 200 miles an hour, that backscatter's unbelievably difficult to read. It just doesn't work. You have to go with a slow-moving ground vehicle, and you have to take readings that take 3 to 5 minutes. Gather that information, drive forward 100 feet, and do it again. Drive forward 100 feet and do it again. You have to make a grid. It's painstaking. It takes days to cover maybe 100 square miles. It's very difficult to do by air. By the time you've flown over it, you've missed the signal. So we have some ideas about this. Matt from Florida on line 2, you're on the program. Welcome to X Squared Radio.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. I was thinking on this that, of course, the NSA took Lake Vostok. Of course they did. Our government will use national security to justify anything at this point. And
yeah, I mean, that's where the budget ultimately comes from, right? It's the headwaters. Anything that's secret or of value or you know, might lead to some ancient weapon system or ancient propulsion system, JPL's not going to get it.
Oh, no. And actually, it's pretty curious that JPL was involved in this to begin with.
I co-opted JPL. We weren't interested in Antarctic ice.
Exactly. I mean, if there's a radiation source coming from the bottom of an Antarctic lake and JPL is involved, I think it's pretty clear what we're dealing with. But well, at the same time, I'm not really sure if JPL really was involved. I mean, I still have to read these articles and vet all these sources myself, but at the same time, if this is true, we know what we're dealing with here.
Well, I'm trying to vet it myself. I know that Vostok is a multinational station. 25 people going down there basically on beans and rice. These people are not making a lot of money. They're going down there on grants. They have to submit their proposals and go down there on grants and drill for ice. And it's all part of a career building, you know, postdoc or pre-doctorate stint, you know, where you do your time down in the frozen land of the Antarctic. And it's quite possible that JPL might be one of the sources of that funding, some of that grant funding. But I go to the National Science Foundation and look up these grants. They have a polar research division. It has nothing to do with JPL.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And, I mean, knowing what we know, things just get a little bit more obvious. as we look into these things. So,
well, that's a blanket statement. I would say suspect what we suspect, that if, and I qualify the idea of radiation coming from Lake Vostok. You know, radiation could just be, you know, background radiation, uranium radiation. I mean, my degree's in nuclear chemistry. So when someone says radiation, I got to say, okay, what's the nuclide? What is the nature, what is the species of the radiation?
Yeah, and actually what I was thinking was,
that's,
is there not some way to look at that radiation and maybe do something along the lines of, if it's some sort of, if it's giving off some sort of light, maybe even spectroscopy?
Well, sure.
Then we can probably see what kind of metal this is.
Yeah, if we're talking about gamma or, well, not that deep, but if it's gamma spectroscopy that we're doing, and we discover that this is some refined or enriched source of radiation, now we're talking a power supply.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking something that's not natural. It was built, and it's leaking. And that does become a national security issue.
Yeah, and even worse, my concern isn't so much that the project was stopped at that point. It's what happens when our government wants to go down there and get that. That's not the sort of thing we need them having.
It? What is it? Is it something that was put under the ice? Is it something that existed before the ice was there? And so, it's old, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, that was my comment. This is a very interesting issue. Looking forward to looking into it. Thanks for bringing it up.
I appreciate it. I definitely appreciate the call. And if you discover anything, you know, send it to the station and they'll flash it to me, and or call me back and let me know. You know, having more eyes than mine out there clicking away, you know, once you get about 30 pages deep into Google, you start going astray. I got to say, half the information on the web you can't find with Google. You got to know the website. So if we got some hackers out there that know where this stuff is coming from, I would appreciate the sources, because we want to get to the point. Thanks so much for the call, Matt. Enjoy your week. Have a productive week down there in Florida.
All right. You too, Brooke.
So, and this raises a really good question. If this radiation really is refined, that is to say it's something that is enriched, and by enriched, the way natural radiation or natural radioactive materials like uranium are enriched is to accelerate neutrons, usually using magnetics or electromagnetics, and fire them at pretty high velocity into the chunk of uranium. And over time, a lot of these neutrons will stick. And as they stick, the molecular weight of the uranium begins to increase. And as it increases, it becomes even more active and more radioactive. And the only way to keep it contained is to encapsulate it with lead rods, so that the lead absorbs the neutrons and then you don't go to thermal runaway. This is what they use to fire nuclear reactors and to boil the steam. And this is what drives nuclear-powered submarines. But it also can be used to convert directly into electricity with higher technology. That being said, if there's a power supply, a nuclear power supply powering this site, this large 45 to 65 mile in diameter metallic disc that happens to be under the ice, I would say that the United States wants to be there first. They don't want another country hauling whatever it is out of there, or even worse, making a shaft down into it and going down in there and discovering what that technology is without us being there. Now, that does become a national security issue because we're just greedy that way. We want all this advanced, especially if it's – and I was the alien, and that's kind of where I was going with my questions with Matt. If this does go back 420,000 years or goes back 14 million years, it would be consistent with what – archaeologists such as Michael Cremo have discovered, that there have been societies on Earth. They have been advanced. They did have machinery. They did have the ability to refine metals and to use them. And somehow they left or were wiped out or never had a huge contingency like we do now, almost 7 billion souls on the Earth. And maybe, possibly, they were from somewhere else. And they came here and they established a base. And that base was, through some kind of cataclysm, shifted, buried under the ice. That would kind of harsh your whole day right there. And it would also probably make the rest of the planet inhospitable for a while. Well, let's continue. After these unprecedented low-altitude aerial surveys over Lake Vostok were done, they began to chart gravitational, magnetic, and thermal activity under the ice. In the course of doing so, of course, they make this stunning find, a huge magnetic anomaly. And you can read about this, but, you know, it's getting a little tricky because it used to be at a website called polar.org, like polar bear, polar.org, and it was the Arctic Sun, which was a newspaper that was published and published a lot of the new finds and different things that had happened down there. But if you go looking for polar.org, the site has been removed, and you are forwarded to a National Science Foundation site where portions of the Antarctic Sun, are published, but the rest of them are not. So it's clear that somebody has gotten to polar.org, dismantled it, and has stopped this non-of classified information. Anyway, it was discovered covering the entire southeast portion of the shore of the lake. Now, keep in mind, this lake's about 100 miles long. Covering the entire southeast portion of the shore of this lake, this remarkable anomaly, which is discrepant from the background. You know, when you do background checks, usually this is done with a Geiger-type device. Geiger was the inventor of the Geiger tube. The Geiger tube is basically a tube with gas in it with a single wire going down the middle of the tube. What happens is as the gamma radiation, what we call a scintillation, comes into the tube, the aluminum of the side of the tube, aluminum is just a wide open window to this kind of stuff, not very dense at all. It hits that gas, and when it hits the gas, it sputters off electrons. The electrons are picked up by the wire. The wire conducts the electron to what's called a photomultiplier tube. It takes that electron and multiplies it by millions of times to where we get a proportional signal, a tick or a movement of a needle. In any case, what happens is we take the imperceptible and we amplify it to the perceptible, and we do it proportionally. So we take background radiation first so that we can tell what, you know, zero is, whether it's, you know, just a few tiny ticks per second or a few ticks per minute, and then we hit something that spikes. Then we know the difference between the discrepant and the background, and that's what we're talking about here. So get this. This anomaly, which is discrepant from the background by over 1,000 nanoteslas, a significant variance compared to daily variations in the Earth's magnetic field, of course, it'd be caused by could, of course, be caused by natural processes. Not very likely, but it could. You could have an errant chunk of uranium down there causing something like that, or you could have a anomaly in the magnetic flux of the Earth which could cause this 1,000 nanotesla spike over this entire southern shore of Lake Vostok. There is, as always, an equally viable alternative explanation. An anomaly like this could be caused by an accumulation of metals, the kind you would get if you found the ruins of an ancient buried city. Okay, there it is. It's out in the open. Now, an ancient buried city not made of rock, not made of stone, not like the Maya, not like Egypt. Uh-uh. This is made out of metal. This is made out of metal. What kind of metal remains to be seen, but it is neutron activated, which means that it is putting off radiation in the range that that we should be able to tell what metal it is. Neutron activation is a marvelous way of doing spectroscopy. You can put you can take your ring, your class ring, and you can stick it into the system, into the detector. You can transport it over to the californium source. You can bombard it with neutrons. You can then vacuum it over to the scintillation chamber, the quiet chamber, and wait for it to decay. As these neutrons come off of the metal, which they will do in various varying times, depends on the metal, how sticky they are relative to the neutrons. But as the neutrons come off, because they're attached to nuclei of a certain size, they release a photon of a very specific frequency. And that's how you can tell how much gold and how much copper is in your ring. And this is how oncology is done today. We neutron activate metals, mostly bismuth, inside of man-made molecules like enzymes or different kinds of nanomolecules that are mechanically built or made through artificial means, capturing the bismuth in a buckyball or a bucky tube somewhere, which is a like a geodesic dome made of carbon atoms. The bismuth grabs up the neutron, holds on to it for a couple of hours. In that time that it's been neutron activated, it is injected into the patient, which hopefully the matrix of that injection is such that it goes right to where the cancer is in the body. So if it's lymphoma, or if it's bone cancer, or if it's some kind of neurocancer, either in muscles or in the brain, it will go right to that very dense, which fortunately for the oncological treatment, cancerous tissue is much more dense than healthy tissue. And so when the neutron comes off as an alpha decay, whatever it strikes, it kills. And most likely, it is going to kill a cancerous cell. So it's delivered locally in the alpha. Alpha radiation doesn't penetrate very far. It kills what's in the general neighborhood. But that being said, these neutrons are flying out of this power source that's down there, activating all the metals. And if we can get a detector close enough, we could pick up the frequency of the decays, in other words, the photon that's coming off of those metals, and we can tell what it is, whether it's titanium or aluminum or iron or zinc or something that's not from this world. It would be easy to do if we could grab those neutrons. It's going to take getting a detector close enough. And by a detector, I mean something like a sodium iodide crystal would be the most likely one, not a Geiger tube, because a Geiger tube can't really tell the difference between one photon and another. Once the photon comes in and activates the gas and sputters off these electrons, they're picked up by the wire. All you get's a tick. You don't get to tell what it is. You just get a tick. But if it's a sodium iodide crystal, you can tell the actual frequency of that decay, and now you can match it against sources like cesium or something like that, and you can compare it. And you can find out what metal it might be, iron or titanium or even an alloy of steel, right down to the molecule. That's why it would be so important to get in there. I think it would be highly irresponsible to punch a hole into this high-pressure environment and let radioactive, biologic-laden air into our atmosphere. I'm not as worried about contaminating that environment as I am our environment being contaminated with something that's been buried for 14 million years. So let's read about this again. There is, as always, an equally viable alternative explanation, and I would say that that equality is not an equality. I think it's an inequality. It is highly likely that an anomaly like this could also be caused by an accumulation of metals, the kind you would get if you found the ruins of an ancient buried city. And I don't think that anybody built a city under the ice. I honestly don't think the Nazis went down there, built a tunnel, and built an under ice city. It's just not likely. There is a growing trend toward the acceptance of the notion of catastrophism. Oh, my goodness. The millions of years, because we compare catastrophism to humanism very well in that 1,500-page, three-volume work on the 2012 end times. There is a growing trend toward the acceptance of the notion of catastrophism as a viable alternative to the conventional geologic models. This is in opposition to the current but retreating geological model called gradualism, the concept that geologic changes only happen slowly over eons. Well, we know better now because we've actually witnessed geologic changes taking place right before our eyes in an afternoon. And had we shown up a week later, we would have said, oh, that took 30,000 years to occur. However, more and more evidence has mounted from the Vostok ice cores, for example, that climatological changes can happen rapidly. In other words, from the very ice cores that they're digging up on their way to the lake underneath Vostok, they have learned these climatic changes, and I'm talking about global climatological changes. Don't happen over hundreds of feet of ice. They happen in a few inches of ice, which means that the changes happen rapidly. Some attribute these catastrophic changes in the record to sudden polar shifts. Imagine that. Many researchers from a variety of evidence have put the last such sudden shift. Ooh. Not at 600,000 years ago, as we learned from our media, the Discovery Channel and the History Channel. No, no, no. This shift, only 13,000 years ago. 13,000 years ago. That's really, really close to the 9500 BC event theorized and documented by Allen and Dallaire in their wonderful book, Cataclysm, The Day the Earth Nearly Died. By the way, we have tried for years to get a hold of Allen and Dallaire. We believe now that they probably are pen names, but the science is absolutely irrefutable. This is a phenomenal book. Now, it reads as dry as Antarctic air. So if you're not into a scientific read, you better read the audiobook. But if you're fascinated by paleobiology and paleobotany and the idea that there were advanced humanoids living some 55 million years ago and that this event that occurred 11,500 years ago, 9500 B.C., actually captured what we once thought were prehistoric animals in a muck vent, several muck vents. To tell you what a muck vent is, when you have a global tidal wave or you have a pole shift and oceans come out of their bounds and go slamming into the tropical forests, they have a tendency to grind up everything in their path. All right, once those waters go sloshing up the mountains, everything in its path has been pulverized to sand, including the biological life, dinosaurs, humans, saber-toothed tigers, giant sharks, all of that, into one muddy slurry. And that slurry is then pushed up the mountains at subsonic speed. It slams into every nook and cranny in those mountains, and then slowly it recedes and the muck freezes. And when it freezes, it preserves it. Allen and Dallaire went into these mountains and core drilled these muck vents where this stuff had solidified. And that's exactly what they found. Only 11,500 years ago, and they found giant sharks, saber-toothed tigers, and human bones all existing at the same time. So those who think that Adam showed up 6,000 years ago, you need to realize that that is all figurative, and the facts tell something else. But now we have ice cores from Antarctica that are proving that some catastrophic change that will support the idea of a pole shift took place around 13,000 years ago. That's very close. That's only 1,500 years off of Allen and Dallaire's idea and their theory and what they found in muck vents. Very interesting indeed. Under the catastrophic model, Antarctica might well have been temperate, even a jungle continent. In other words, up closer to the equator. As recently as 13,000 year time frame, a sudden change in the Earth's alignment relative to the sun would have plunged this once hospitable land into a perpetual freezing hell, as cold as Mars in some places. Indeed, it is easy to see Antarctica as Hitler did, as the source of worldwide Atlantis legends we have all heard and read. According to at least one source, Dr. Wernher von Braun of NASA was convinced that Hitler's belief in Atlantis below the ice was correct. Now, this could occur from two different ways. One is the Earth did indeed tilt on its axis. If the Earth was more straight up and down on its axis and tilted 20.5 degrees relative. By the way, that's why we have seasons, you know. As we the sun, the Earth revolves on its axis every 24 hours, but every 365 1/4 days, the Earth makes a trek completely around the sun. Tilted on its axis at 23 degrees, when we're on one side of the sun, it is summer in the northern hemisphere, and when we're on the other side of the sun, it is winter in the northern hemisphere. However, if the Earth were tilted more up and down, that is to say, the equator pointed more directly toward the sun instead of tilted 23 degrees away from it, would be very small. And there'd be more of a temperature equilibrium on the Earth, which would mean it would be more tropical, definitely more lush in the upper latitudes. Now, the interesting thing is that there's another theory that makes this kind of fit together, although you'd have to go back further than 13,000 years, but not a whole bunch further, not like back to when the Earth cooled. And that is a theory called the expanding Earth theory. Now, if you're a first-time listener to this program, this might seem new to you. If you've heard this program over a number of years, we have talked about expanding Earth theory here. If you would like to learn about it in 10 minutes or less, you can go to Neil Adams' website. Just look him up. You'll find him. He is a geology teacher, and he produced a YouTube which explains the theory very well in about 10 or 15 minutes. I'll try to do it without pictures here for you. One of the things that we've discovered as we look at the Earth from space, from satellites, is that all the continents seem to fit together. And it doesn't take rocket scientists, literally, to notice that North and South America kind of fit up neatly against Europe and Africa. It's just not that difficult to figure out. During the time when we thought we were really smart, 30,
30s and 40s, we had an idea that all the land masses came together in one place. It was, we had two names that were kind of popular. You can look them up yourself. One is Gondwana land, and the other one is Pangaea. Now, a lot of you have heard the word Pangaea. One supercontinent over on one side of the world while the rest of the world was covered in water. Well, both of those names, both of those ideas have been completely shot apart by plate tectonic specialists. One of the things that they notice is it's not actually the continents, but rather the continental shelves that fit together. And the idea that only one side of them fit together is erroneous, because actually both sides of them fit together. And if both sides of them fit together, it's a little difficult to do unless you shrink planet Earth. If you shrink planet Earth to approximately one-third its present diameter, guess what? All the continents, including New Zealand and Antarctica and Australia, all fit together precisely, accurately, with very little loss for erosion. They all fit together. Not a problem. But if they all fit together, one has to say to themselves, well, that would mean that more of the Earth was covered with water. And if that was true, there'd have to be supporting evidence like layers of seashells up in the mountains, clams, things like that, in areas that, you know, hasn't seen water since we've known about it. And guess what? If you go to Appalachians, which are some of the oldest mountains in the world, if you go to the Himalayas, the highest, oldest mountain range on the planet, if you go to the Rockies, if you go to the Wasatch, if you go to the Alps, guess what you see? High up in the mountains, layers of seashells, layers of fossilized sea life, both plant and animal. They were, those mountains were indeed covered with mountains, or with water, with ocean. The other thing, the other piece of evidence that you'd have to find is you'd have to find a disparity or a difference between dry land age and sea floor age. And I mean, it had to, you know, it had to be significant. They can't just be close to the same age and have this expanding Earth theory kind of fit. What you discover when you look at this is something very remarkable. Dry land ages between 2.5 and 4.5 billion years old. Depends on when it was volcanically cleansed. Quite interesting in comparison to the oldest seafloor, which happens to be only 70 million years old. 4.5 billion years old, 70 million years old. And by the way, some of the ocean floor is as young as 10 million years. That's like last weekend, geologically speaking. What it lends itself to the support of is the idea that the crust broke apart and filled in with volcanic material which made up the sea floor. And by the way, it wouldn't be a very smooth process. There should be areas of deep crevices, places that broke apart and violently so and didn't fill in very well, a la the Mindanao Trench. And there'd be places of great stability and smoothness and consistency, a la the Gulf of Mexico or the Red Sea. There are, in fact, those places. So expanding Earth theory would also possibly support the idea that if the crust is three times the diameter that it once was when the Earth cooled, what's left behind? What filled up the Earth? What is inside planet Earth? Well, we got to have a metallic core spinning like mad to kind of support the idea that we have a great magnetosphere. Very, very interesting stuff as all this fits together
Vostok's ancient what? City? Power supply? Sitting underneath the ice of Antarctica is now a national security focus? Well, that becomes pretty interesting. I am fascinated by it, and I hope you are too. We're going to take a quick break. We will take, let's take about 4 minutes, and we'll come back after this, and we'll polish off the rest of the program. X Squared Radio, live on the BBS Radio Network. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Thanks for being here. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from southern Mississippi, about 90 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico. Our AccuWindow forecast, 65 degrees and clear. Hope it's nice where you are. I know some places are going to get snow up in the north. Seen a lot of weather extremes lately. And we really don't know what to make of it. Our sun seems to be waking up. New sunspots, solar flares, threatening our microelectronic way of life. I would say that we're empowered, though. I would say that we're connected globally as a race. Humans, earthlings, less nationality and more of a planetary way of life. If we can ever learn to live within the resources of this planet, we will soon learn to live within the resources of our solar system. Once we do that, we may be eligible to rejoin the galactic community. I have people from time to time kind of look at me sideways and you kind of pick up on their thoughts like, you don't really believe in UFOs, do you? And I think some of you probably face that from time to time too. And I can tell you that the scientific answer would be to answer a question with a question. So when someone says to you, you don't really believe in UFOs, do you, aliens and all that, all you really have to do is look at them sideways and say, come on, you don't honestly believe we're alone in the universe, do you? And that will pretty much put an end to that. Whether or not there are UFOs flying around everywhere, as some claim, whether or not there are dozens of alien races living on the Earth or not, is irrelevant. We are talking about a binary choice here. Are we or are we not an anomaly in the universe? I think each one of us listening tonight and those who we love and live with and work with would admit that we are not. That we are, in fact, eternal beings having a mortal experience here on this earth, and it may not have been our only one. And I would think many of you listening to this program tonight have a feeling in the back of your mind that you're not from this neighborhood. Not that you don't belong here, far from it. You are here for a reason. Whether you have found that reason or not is also not relevant. That reason is to affect the universe in whatever way you dream. And if you're going through your time here on the earth, punctuating it with paychecks or family vacations, or whether you are managing it moment by moment is a matter of awareness and choice before you are 100% responsible for your own life condition. If you would like to find out more about that life condition and what you can do to unlock the abundance of the universe, and believe me, if you're dreaming too small, you'll discover it so fast. Dream large. Dream correctly. Use the process and read about it in the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. It's available wherever fine books are sold. But I have to tell you, electronic sales of books have now surpassed the sale of books in bookstores. So my favorite place to buy this book would be at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Why would I do that? Well, I might spend a dollar or two more than I will at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or eCampus. But if I buy from rememberingthefuturebook.com, I get the book autographed and I get the audio version for free. So if you're not a real good reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. And if you don't really like the idea of killing trees and hauling around a bunch of paper, once you've read a book, the audio book is a mere $7.95. You can pick it up, rememberingthefuturebook.com. If you're a Kindle reader, awesome. We applaud you. Awesome technology. We love the Amazon Kindle. You can buy the book by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com and clicking on the Nook link, and you will find it. And if you're a Nook reader, Kindle or Nook, either one, they're available right there. X Squared Radio is dedicated to the idea that humans, once given all the knowledge that they need, will eventually make the right decision. We don't withhold anything. We might throw our opinion in there, but we'll tell you that it's our opinion. The idea is to arouse your faculties so that you can be empowered to make correct choices, not only with yourself, but with your family, with your community. And if you feel a need to get involved in your community and take off your cloak of apathy, we applaud you. For that is why we are here. And that is why we will be back in 40 seconds to continue our talk about Lake Vostok and what is under the ice, how it could affect us, what is discovered there, and why it is so critical that we have civilian oversight to these ancient discoveries. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to launch its final hour. There is no shortage of stories and rumors about what's going on down at Lake Vostok. It's an easy thing to do, you know, when you're living in four or five mobile homes down on the ice. And I also got to let you know that it's not the aging scientists that go down there and do this kind of research. You really have to be in shape. And even some of the young people that go down there, I mean, it just trashes them. They have health problems. They have psychological problems. Well, let's cover a couple of those because they get kind of controversial and they get stirred up around different things, and I want to set the record straight. Whether the story about the JPL press conference where Miss Shingteller made her statement about the NSA and national security issues is true or not. The truth, and we have yet to substantiate this actual report, but we're getting closer. Still, stranger things began to happen down south. Initially, it was reported that the doctor at the South Pole, this is the second replacement in 2 years at the Admundson Scott base, needed an unprecedented airlift extraction late in the season because of complications from a gallstone. Now, that's understandable. Then, coincident with that, other reports began to surface of the need for four more medical extractions in an equally unprecedented fashion from the coastal base at McMurdo Station, the largest U.S. base on the entire continent. Again, as with the previously reported deaths, the reasons were somewhat mysterious as to the precise need for these emergency medical extractions. Public speculation has hinged on the idea that someone coming into McMurdo from New Zealand brought something with them from home. You know, kids can carry the plague and it doesn't show up till after you arrive at work. Some kind of infectious disease that was subsequently spread among the isolated population there. You know, you're kind of in close quarters there. It's not like you have your own pad, your own gymnasium, your own hot tub where you can work out. Everything's kind of a group affair down there. One is that some special project has, against all scientific environmental prudence, indeed drilled through the ice into the Lake Vostok ecosystem, clandestinely, of course, and the participants have suddenly found themselves exposed to something for which their bodies literally had no immunity, something not extant in the rest of Earth's biosphere for between 13,000 and several million years. Well, I dare say that if that had happened, if they had in fact drilled into the biosphere of the airspace above Lake Vostok, not only would they know the headspace analysis, I think they did release some kind of report that said it was hyper-oxygenated, that is to say more oxygen in that space than exists in our own atmosphere. And the question was raised by my good friend Kevin Smith, how in the world would they know if the atmosphere was hyper-oxygenated if they hadn't already sampled the headspace? Excellent observation, my friend. But had they tapped into this, I would say everyone who was within smelling distance of that would definitely have to fight off some kind of antigen. Now, complicating the picture is the fact that the extractees, those people that we just talked about, these emergency extractions of these people, these extractees are not research scientists or long-term support personnel, but instead are all employees of Raytheon Corporation, a high-tech firm that is deeply involved in a variety of black ops programs for the U.S. government all around the world. And this is absolutely true. All of those that were extracted under these unprecedented emergency situations, by the way, just to give you an idea how difficult this is, once the summer ends and the weather turns from its normal balmy minus 30 degrees to minus 70 degrees or minus 80 degrees, there's not a whole lot of outside activity, okay? You man the rig, or you do maintenance, or you write papers, or you communicate with loved ones over the internet, or you look through the telescope and make reports. Now, that being said, the sun will come up in 6 months. The sun will come up, and there will be dawn again, hopefully. But once it goes dark down there, the only way out is if they fly a C-130. That's for those of you that know what a Hercules is or a C-130, they're the big four-engine turboprop jobs that you see the National Guard flying around that has the little drawbridge in the back, that kind of airplane. Not the jet ones, but the turboprop ones. They land on the ice with big skis, and then you put your what's called a cookie sheet. A cookie sheet is a 108-inch by 65-inch plate with your gear lashed to it, and then it's brought down on some kind of treaded vehicle where they can drive it to where it can be off-packed and stock the station again. But this is a big deal to fly down there in the dark, in the cold, and land that airplane on the ice to extract somebody is an expensive ordeal. It takes a significant amount of cash to get that to happen. Normally, they leave those guys alone, and they come back in 6 months. Of course, they've been talking to them, you know, on the internet and everything, so they know they're still alive. But still, you got to take care of yourself. You're at 11,400 feet. You're at minus 40 degrees dew point minimum, which means there's no moisture in the air whatsoever. Every time you exhale, you are losing water. So you really have to take extra precautions to take care of yourself. You're going to lose weight, and you're probably going to get a little ill. But the idea that all of these employees that were removed were Raytheon Corporation employees, and Raytheon and, you know, Lockheed Skunk Works both have the reputation for being involved in these off-budget projects, which I'm sure Vostok is one of them. And all of these guys had to be extracted without waiting out the winter. They couldn't hang out. And I don't think it was for health reasons. That's my personal opinion. All right. This idea that these two simultaneous emergencies are actually due to some kind of black ops fiasco in Antarctica is reinforced by another little notice story. We found this coming out of the Amundsen Scott base, that the doctor being brought in to replace the ailing doctor has been asked to also bring in an emergency supply of salt. Yeah, table salt. An emergency supply of salt. She's even been asked to stuff her own pockets full of salt packets. Ostensibly because there is no room on the rescue aircraft itself. This is obviously a silly, thinly veiled cover story. As I told you, it's a Hercules or a C-130. That's capable of carrying 40,000 pounds of freight. I doubt a few 50-pound sacks of salt would have overburdened it, unless they went down there in an otter. Now, if they went down there in an otter, this is basically a four-seater turboprop airplane. It's got about 750 horsepower, and it's a single-engine plane. Now, they have two-engine models, too, but they could still carry a couple hundred pounds of salt with no problem. So to say that they couldn't take any is ridiculous. And even so, her stuffing her pockets full of salt would not change the time of day. Anyway, it's designed to tell someone outside something. Salt is crucial to survival in outdoor conditions in Antarctica. The air is so dry that unless someone exposed to the outdoors there had a good supply of salt, they are likely to face the possibility of death by mineral depletion and dehydration. Obviously, the base, after years of operation, would have a pretty good handle on just how much salt is needed until the next resupply plane arrives. So how is it that they suddenly find themselves desperately without any of it left? Doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. Why would they tell the doctor to stuff her pockets full of salt? Maybe because they suddenly had a unique situation. Maybe because a team of scientists and engineers from Raytheon spent a lot of unplanned days out on the windswept ice, frantically drilling against the clock in an all-out effort to break through to the lake below. And in the process, used far more than the normal complement of salt to survive. Either that or they were catching fish and putting them on salt, which I highly doubt. The other possibility for the sudden simultaneous evacuations is even more extraordinary. Oh, yeah. What if these Raytheon black ops personnel did indeed find something in their secret drilling under Vostok and needed to get it back to civilization ASAP for in-depth study? Under this scenario, the whole idea of an outbreak is simply a ruse to cover the need for a large airplane, a C-130 or a Hercules, dramatically. By the way, the difference is the C-130 is the green one that you see flying around, the military one. They're not allowed to carry freight inside the United States. It's against FAA regulations. The Hercules, however, is the civilian version of it, and it is allowed to carry freight inside the United States. There's a difference. All right. To cover the need for a large airplane, dramatically visiting McMurdo at a time never attempted in all its years before, the only way out for something very important from the continent. Remember, this is a plane that can carry 40,000 pounds. It can carry tanks and jeeps and troops. It can carry anything that they can haul up out of that ice. unless it's, of course, the whole 65-mile-long complex. It couldn't haul that. How do you cover such an operation? You put all the medical hints out there and wait for the internet conspiracists to figure it out, that there has been some kind of outbreak at McMurdo. There has been no official confirmation of this theory, by the way, all the while covering your real agenda, which is to get your hands on a genuine artifact from Zep Tepe before the dead of the Antarctic winter makes any such attempt this year impossible. Now, that begins to make sense, that you fake a medical emergency so that the outside press says, oh, well, it's simple. These guys weren't acclimated to it. They got sick. They had to be hauled out of there. People, the coincidence that these four were all Raytheon, they were not scientists, they were not long-term employees. What were Raytheon employees doing down there? Basically, one-fifth of the personnel the whole base could support were Raytheon operatives. What were they doing hauling a C-130 down there right before winter, unprecedented? The place was stocked and ready to hole up for the winter. What in the world were they hauling out of there that they needed a plane that big? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Why was the doctor asked to stuff her pockets full of salt? It's a code. It's a code. The civilians that were down there were telling the doctor, fill your pockets with salt and come on down. That part made it into the press. Somebody in the press should have been shaking their head. Something doesn't make any sense here, people. They should have taken the hint and gone down there and found out what's going on. Anybody that believes there's a radioactive anomaly that's 65 miles by 45 miles under the ice, and that the NSA is even remotely interested in it, that they would leave it alone because of the Australian Treaty Secretariat saying, oh, no, no, no. We don't want to contaminate that pristine environment underneath that ice. We're going to think this out, even if we have to delay drilling for a year. I know we're within 98 feet, but we're going to wait. We're going to put a hot lance down there and a camera, and we're going to take a look. Uh-huh. They probably already have people down there working on that site. They probably already have samples that they've hauled up out of there. Something's going to happen, and that whole drilling operation is going to be shut down. Only it won't be shut down. That's my personal opinion. If you've got a thought about it, I would love to hear about it. We've got about 20 minutes left on the program. 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet. And by the way, be careful out there because, you know, we've got some solar flares causing real problems. I know the proton count is low, but that doesn't mean that these flares aren't really kicking it out. So be careful. 530-413-4515 if you're east of Earth, and 530-413-4520 if you're west of Earth. We don't have a toll-free access globally because we don't need it. You can use Skype, you can use your cell phone, call in, pose your question. If you're worried about the charges, we'll handle it quickly, and you can listen to the answer on the air. We'd love to hear from you. What is your opinion? What's going on down there at Lake Vostok? You've heard about it for years. It's just a little tiny outpost, three or four mobile homes, highly insulated and bolted to the ice. 25 people for a summertime complement, 13 through the winter. All they're doing is taking ice cores, cataloging them, studying them, taking slices of them, looking at them under a microscope, looking at ancient microbes that might be in there, taking gas analysis, headspace analysis of the ice once it's melted, trying to figure out what the ancient atmosphere was like because it became part of that ice when it was formed. What are they doing down there? Why would you send Raytheon employees, not scientists, not long-term employees down there? These are all questions for which I'm sure we will never find an answer. But I'd like to hear your opinion on those answers. I'd like to know what you think is going on down in Vostok. Why do you think there would be an ancient radioactive anomaly 65 miles long and 45 miles wide sitting under the ice? Is it a city? Is it a ship? Is it a complex or a building of some kind? There's one under the ice at the edge of the lake in Vostok, and there's another one that's in the north that was discovered by the outpost Alert. Alert is way up on the Canadian North Country, and it was discovered through through seismic activity. It's big. It's huge. And if you think we're just sitting back saying, oh, that's nice. How scientifically interesting. Well, maybe one day we'll speculate on it. If you think we're sitting back like that, well, that's quite possible. I have my doubts. When ancient technologies make themselves known, they usually become someone's property in that giant warehouse of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. By the way, by way of news, I don't know if you know this or not, but the museum in Egypt, the Cairo Museum, is quite old. The building is over 100 years old. And it's large, but it's not very well laid out. And it's dirty, and it's not well lit, and the cases are made of wood and glass, and you know, things are handwritten and kind of stuffed in cases, and you kind of look at it, and the museum itself is a museum. Well, in this recent protest in Egypt, it was designed to shut down the status quo, to shut down the operation of things. And there are divisions in Egypt that watch over Egypt's most valuable natural resource, which is its antiquities. And the head of the antiquities department or division or ministry is Zawi Hawass, ruling with an iron fist, oh my goodness, keeping the outside archaeologists away from new finds so that they can be the claimants. They can release it to the world in their own way. You got to respect that. It's their country. They inherited all this stuff. They had no idea it was worth anything until the 1950s or 1960s when tourists started pouring into Egypt and started packing everything off because the Egyptians didn't care about it. All they cared about was a few pounds or a few dollars. You could take anything you wanted. Slowly but surely, the iron-fisted Zawi Hawass gathered things up and put them in the museum at Cairo. One of the most world-renowned displays is that of King Tut. Well, the smoke has cleared, the glass has been swept up, and sure enough, King Tut's display is missing from the museum. And from Lake Tahoe, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hi, Brooks. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Mississippi's finally warming up a little bit, and we're getting some work done down here.
That's good. Great show tonight. I haven't been able to listen for a while, and this one, I'm glad I tuned in. You do biodiesel. I think this is all beginning to tie in. There's two items I've caught in the news lately. One is that the methane has disappeared in the Gulf due to the algae microbes they injected. I sent you an email with the links and everything because you'll probably want to look into it later. The second one is something I came on quite by accident on a YouTube video, but the bottom of this gentleman's where they give the description, he is saying that diatoms increase the electrical activity in your body. The mitochondria, as it is, need to change food into electricity to run your body. This is changing. The sun is electricity as you know it. You live on electricity. People are electric. And food is converted to electricity by mitochondria.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. The mitochondria control the respiration of a molecule called ATP. That's why it's the body's little powerhouses. And most of the mitochondria exist in the brain and in muscles. And you can change that content by exercise, but that's basically true. It's electrochemical, but it's basically true.
And the other thing that he mentioned that caught my attention was the element in pure earth water, H2O2, is the green rivers that they sing about. Underground rivers running through limestone and sulfur produce H2O2 eternal, the fountain of youth water.
Well, H2O2 is hydrogen peroxide, and it can hyperoxygenate the body. It also kills gram-positive bacteria, which is the more virulent bacteria. So it can make you pretty healthful. And so that could be pretty much true. It depends on how much pressure it's under, but yeah, that's true.
See, I don't come from a scientific background at all, but all of a sudden scientific information is like popping out at me.
Well, you can take ordinary water is deoxygenated. Okay, they try to do it. In fact, they measure the oxygen content in water before they release it from the water treatment plant for you to drink. And the reason they take the oxygen out of the water is because it rusts the pipes. It oxidates the pipes. So they take the oxygen out of the water. Usually eight parts per million is a huge amount of oxygen in water. But you can increase the amount of oxygen in water by dropping a little hydrogen peroxide in there. The problem with that, it only exists in that form for a couple minutes. So if you don't drink the water, it's gone into the atmosphere. Now, there are processes that will put the oxygen into the water. I mean way up there, like 14,000 parts per million. But it takes a quasi-crystalline complex of water, not like salt, but water will form into populations because water, as you know, is H2O, but it has two free electrons on the oxygen molecule, which like to hook up with other hydrogen atoms. And they do this in kind of a matrix that kind of forms a memory for the water. And it can ultra-hydrate cells in a very healthful way. So it only takes a little bit of this water to actually change a lot of water into something that will be healthy for you. Most of the time, it won't exist outside the human body very long. But there are companies. One is Langenberg in Eugene, Oregon. And they make a process where this water will stay together hyperoxygenated for long periods of time. But not many companies out there figured it out. It's a deionization process and then a re-oxygenating process that's difficult to do.
To add, I know this doesn't seem to tie into what you're saying, but I should have read this from the beginning. It says, wars are to destroy history. And the subterranean H2O2 green fountain of youth rivers, which are at the magnetic power points of Earth, which you're speaking of one tonight, I'm sure.
History, yeah, it very well could be.
Pure preferred history.
I know the headspace above this lake will be an indication of what's in the water. That's just, Boyle's Law. So that's... For them to say that the atmosphere above this lake is hyperoxygenated without actually sampling it is just not possible. You have to take a headspace analysis, which means they've already poked through to it.
Mm-hmm.
They've already been there.
It just seems like with what, if that's true in the Gulf also, They're learning everything and learning how to market it before they let it out.
Oh, I'm sure.
Very possibly, yes.
I don't know how much methane there is in the Gulf Stream, because it's actually a warm, cold conveyor belt that goes up and down between the waters off the coast of Florida, about 90 miles, and all the way over to the western coast of Ireland. The cold water goes north and the warm water comes south, and it just kind of makes a cycle like that. And the flow.
So was that disinfo about the methane explosions that might occur around the Gulf? Was that disinfo?
No, it isn't disinformation, because that the motion of that water on the very bottom of the sea, in the very deepest parts of the ocean, there's a layer of liquid methane. Now, it's under a lot of pressure, and it's cold enough that it stays liquid. Off the coast of Japan is probably one of the most notable oceans of methane. And what the Japanese have done is they've put membranes under the water about 500 feet, and it captures this methane as it comes to the surface, and they gather it and use it as a natural resource instead of letting it come to the atmosphere. Now, all is well and good unless the temperature of the ocean comes up. If the temperature of the ocean gets to a point where that methane begins to boil off on the bottom of the ocean, we have a serious problem with our with existing on this planet.
Right. Okay.
But I don't think it's going to happen. We've seen probes go down to the bottom, and what they do is the robot will go down just so deep, and then it seems to bounce off of this other layer like foam rubber. And what it is the methane is much more dense than the water. So the craft, which is neutrally buoyant in the water and can swim around in the water, when it hits the methane, it can't go under it because it floats. It would have to be made much heavier to get down below the methane. So that's how we know where this ocean of methane is on the bottom of the sea.
Now, I live in Lake Tahoe, and evidently when Cousteau was up here, gosh, I think it was in the 70s, he went down to the depths in one of his submarines and came back up and said, humanity's not ready to hear what I saw.
No
Which
kidding.
Has always been kind of a fun mystery to me.
Lake Tahoe is supposed to be really, really deep, like bottomless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know how deep it is.
Interesting thing, I had a friend recently who kind of sees things, said that in Lake Tahoe and quite many, many lakes across the world and rivers and oceans, there is like a bubbling up, and was asking me if I could get any take on it, but I haven't yet, other than maybe a release of pressure. But when you were talking about this today in the lake and everything, it's all just ideas, dot to dot. Somebody else will probably continue.
Well, what do you think's at the bottom of Lake Tahoe?
Pardon?
What do you think's down there at Lake Tahoe that Jacques Cousteau said the world was...
I think it's more than just recently. I think it was about a year ago, a team came in and went underground with the submarine, their submarines. And the only thing they came up and released anyway is they said there were trees down there.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yes, that is interesting. But they didn't really, I thought, for going down and spending thousands of dollars, what they released to the public wasn't very complete. There also is supposedly a major fault, I've also been made aware there's like a lee line leading from here all the way out to Point Arena, which is at the base of the San Andreas Fault.
Well, that makes complete sense. I mean, the Rockies, the Wasatch, all that is tectonically active. You betcha.
Right.
And, I remember... a legend of the Great Salt Lake Valley. They were talking to some Indians that passed this down from generation to generation. They said anciently there was an earthquake, and they said, it was something like a big boom, and then the ocean went away.
Hmm.
So the sea went down into the ground and I guess leaked out to the sea through some fissure that opened up. But Tahoe is really an anomaly because it's so deep and it's fresh water, of course, and icy cold. Mm-hmm. Awesome place to catch fish. But yeah. the water is amazingly clear, too. You can see down a long way into that lake.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Yeah.
It's interesting. I've always wanted to spend some time scuba diving, but not much to see in fresh water, I can tell you.
A little tricky up here in the altitudes, too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful country,
though. Yeah, they say
though.
The fault goes down below... we live up, we're at 6,200 feet, and I'm not exactly sure of what the elevation of Carson Valley, below us is, but they say it opens up deeper than that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I've been to Carson
City. That's down the mountain, you know, down in the valleys.
Those old ghost towns. I think everybody should take that trip. Carson City and... oh, what are the names of it? Because they have all the old Western shows and everything up there. I always found it fascinating.
Virginia City and Minden and Gardnerville. And, yeah, there's a lot of little towns and little old bars and ghost towns and that kind of thing out there.
It's hard to believe how gold drew so many people from all over the world to that area. And a lot of them hit it. A lot of them struck it rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. Anyway, I will let you go on. I just wanted to add a few little pieces and see if it ends up being part of the equation because I definitely feel like it's something's being hidden.
Well, I do too, and it does fit the equation. X squared is an amazing function. Thank you very much for your contribution.
Yes, you are. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good night.
You have a good night. Bye-bye. Yeah.
All right, Ann. These Earth mysteries, this is what's kept us going for almost 6 years here on X Squared Radio. There's no shortage of them. And I love the callers. You sit out there and listen and come up with your ideas, and sometimes you text them through. I can't wait to open up to the chats. I wasn't able to do it because I've really been skating on thin ice tonight with the bandwidth. I promise you, as the months go on, we're going to get to better and better locations. But I'm on location down here. I'm relocating a Fortune 100 company's manufacturing facility from this state to another state to consolidate it for their two facilities, so we can save a bunch of jobs and keep this process in the U.S. So. I'm not going to mention any company names, but that's what I'm down here doing. In the meantime, our other efforts, those of you that know what we're into, we're not going to mention it on the radio program, those are moving ahead quite nicely. And we appreciate your patronage here on X Squared Radio. If you missed us live, or if you know friends that would like to listen to a program like this, Scientific Talk Radio, about everything that's interesting that you might see on the Discovery Channel, only you don't get to phone call into the Discovery Channel. Spread the word. And if they didn't hear it live, they can always sign up for the archives. And at X Squared Radio, our archives are so reasonable. You can listen to everything we've got for a whole month for $2.50. And if you want it even cheaper than that, you can listen to everything we have, over 1,000 hours of content in great stereo quality for $20 a year. Now, there's no better deal out on the web anywhere. And it takes a few thousand dollars a year to keep the lights on here, to keep the website updated and registered, to pay for airtime. And we don't make any money on this. This is a hobby to me. I just do it because I love doing it. I love talking to you. And I love the discovery of it, and we are affecting the universe by what we're doing here on X Squared Radio. And I appreciate the time to be here with you more than you know. If you have that appreciation as well, you can go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the
archives or the subscription button and sign up today. It's inexpensive. You can do it with PayPal, a check, or your credit card. It's so simple to do, and you can join the X Squared Radio family, the number one paranormal internet talk radio program on the internet. So we will see you again next week right here on X Squared Radio at 5 o'clock Pacific time. Thank you very much. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.